We're on the record.
There are people from this task force, this commission.
We're on the record at 11:23 on Friday, the, what is it? 8th of October, 2010. Judge Stanley Sporkin is with us. On behalf of the commission is represented by Tom Krebs and Bob Hinckley. Judge, do we have your permission to tape record this interview?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Bob?
Judge, we usually leave this question for last when we interview people, but given your illustrious career, we're interested in knowing specifically what you think caused the financial crisis.
I delivered a paper on this, and I guess the first one was May 15th, 2008. And I don't know where this was on the crisis. Was this before? Right before the crisis?
The crisis took the end of the crisis, or the we usually generally think of it happening in September, October, 2008.
Yeah. And you want to put this as part of the record, you can. Well, you have a copy of it, I think.
I do have a copy.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, the author has a copy.
I have it.
Okay. Yeah, here, can I come? And I think what I show there was that there's several things. The first thing, and you know, this is not rocket science. It was an accident waiting to happen. We had, in this country, we had bought in to a number of different concepts that I attribute maybe to the academic economists. Largely it was free trade and things of that kind that got us to the point whereby we turned ourselves from a producing nation into a consumer nation, or great the various phases of our economy, such as the textile industry, such as the steel industries, we started to see them going overseas. And what happened was that this was as a result of two things. One, the business people realizing they can make more profits by doing it overseas because of the cheap labor, and that was facilitated, their movement out, by the union movement, which did not understand what was going to happen the more they would pressure business to raise when they're raising their salaries, and in effect was giving the business community the cover to be able to move their jobs overseas, because they say, look, we're going to be able to do it cheaper over there. And so you had that combination of business and union that really took us down this path, and that when we didn't have the jobs, people couldn't afford their housing. And as you know, there was a move afoot at the same time to permit everybody to buy a property. And of course, just like any other scheme of this kind, there's an end to it, whether it's a Ponzi scheme or you just can't keep it up. So if people don't have jobs, they cannot pay for their houses. They went into default. At the same time that we have is, while in the past we had housing and real estate crises, they were usually confined to that sector. Here, there was a difference that took place, and namely what we did is we monetized the problem by the smartest guys on the block coming up with a concept that what we will do with these mortgages, we will securitize them, and that took it over into the financial arena, went into the financial arena, and the financial arena bought all these instruments, and they got to the point where it was being done without the kind of care that was necessary, and it therefore took a real estate problem into a monetary financial problem, and then when it collapsed the financial problem, it took down the financial structure as well as the real estate structure, and that's why you have this colossal problem.
We could not agree more. That is our premise as well.
Yeah. So that's what happened. And now what we then see, and then what we see now, is in the financial area, where when I wrote that paper in 08, which lays all this out, and what occurred to me is nobody was thinking along those lines. What they were thinking about, what I call the symptoms. The fact that the Bear Stearns went under, Lehman went under, and whatnot. But that's the symptoms of what the underlying... That was
I can't copy front and back without taking it apart. It's sealed.
Okay, that's all right. They were more interested in this one, I think. So the judge was more intrigued, but that's okay.
So the symptoms were that what happened in the financial market, which could have, if we had the proper regulation... And not only the proper regulation, but being effective, it could have curtailed the tremendous losses that took place. That's really, in effect, what happened. It was like a drunk on a binge. We got with the giving the original mortgages out. It was a binge. People were having the greatest times of their life, and it all came and collapsed where it had to collapse. And what bothers me more than anything else is the fact that a country as smart as we are did not see it coming and was not prepared for it. And if anybody starts to tell you that it's different, it's crazy, because even now, when it's now recognized that jobs is the biggest problem, the problem they're having now is putting the genie back into the bottle. You can't, you left the job, how do you do that now? And so, well, we hear from the highest levels of our government, well, we're going to create new jobs. What are the jobs they're going to create? They're going to build windmills. That one, and that's true. That's the words that you're going to build windmills, batteries. We're going to build, and of course, infrastructure, which was tried in the Great Depression, and which obviously. But as I see, other than service jobs in this country, there are not a whole bunch of areas out there where you can create really, really great jobs. I do think, though, if we live long enough, that we can once again become a competitive nation, because the reason that the Chinese and India and whatnot were able to eat our lunch was because they were paying the slave wages. But I think what you're going to see with technology, you're going to see that the cost of labor are not going to be the major costs anymore, and because with robots and everything else. So I think we have another chance of being competitive and bringing back some of these industries here. But I think what kind of jobs they would create, you know, a certain amount of jobs and overseeing the production in marketing and things of that kind, but I do think that I described this in this paper that I wrote, where the title was "Is the Free Market in the Process of Self-Implosion?" And the concept there is that you take anything to extremes, and it will destroy itself. You take the free market and take all restraints off, it will eventually destroy itself. It has to destroy itself. It's almost like that thing you used to see where it gobbles up. because, you know, you have no antitrust laws, you have nothing. So we do need a form of an economy, and the free marketeers, I think, you can't find them anymore, but I do believe that they participated in the bubble, in creating the bubble, on their theory that the free markets will regulate themselves. And I think that I think Greenspan sold us on that, and I think he's willing to admit now that he was wrong. You just can't have unregulated markets. It's like the Israelis, as a group of Israelis, that think that they don't need an army because they're going to be saved by God. God's going to save them. The free markets are not going to.
Is that what you think was taken to extremes and destroyed itself, the free market system?
Well, I think that the free market system without regulation, yeah. Obviously, you need free markets. But just as obviously, you need proper regulation. You can't have that. The greed is too great a factor, and people will cut corners. Look at the recent Goldman Sachs case. Would anybody have ever thought that a company with a great prestige of a Goldman could be could sell something called a synthetic security, which is not a security at all? It's made up. As what was that, Senator McConnell? What was her name? McConnell, the senator from Missouri, that said
McCaskill.
McCaskill, that she said it's nothing more than a Las Vegas gambling casino. There, it's the crap game where a lot of the side bets are taking place.
There's nothing about it that looks like a regular security. In a security, you put money into a common enterprise, you look to get a return on it. There was no common enterprise; it was a bet.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. In my day, if we had found some place out in Utah doing this or somewhere in the hinterlands, we'd put them out of business. I just can't understand the concept. And so regulation, which again was right about the time I wrote that paper, the SEC was under tremendous criticism from people like Greenspan, people like Paulson, telling them that if you over-regulate, all our business is going to go overseas, we're going to lose everything. And there was a tremendous push against the SEC until the Chris Cox, to his great credit, tried to hold them off when they were trying to push them. You had a arbitrage of regulators. People were going to the regulation that was the least onerous. And when you really look back at it now, it's easy to see it, you know. But we got ourselves so caught up in it, so unbelievably caught up and all this stuff. And you now come back, and people like myself, who've been around a little bit, say, how do we ever allow this to happen in this country?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could explore that a little bit.
Sure.
Your explanation of mortgages migrating from the banking sector to where they were regulated to the security sector is very similar to the theory Tom and I are working on. The thing that we noticed is that at this point where they migrate to the security sector, there's very little regulation. Essentially, you have the underwriters, the lawyers, the rating agencies, and to a very limited extent, the SEC, as a result of, among other things, Rule 415 and how shelf offerings are handled at the SEC. Could you comment on that?
Comment in the question of the fact that the regulators were not up to the task of dealing with this?
No, not that so much. Is that by rule they'd taken themselves out of play? The mortgage-backed securities prospectuses essentially were never reviewed.
Well, I don't know that. You people can tell me that, but I do think, years ago, and I guess you'll remember this. We had something called a salad oil case.
Yeah, it was just a little bit before my time, but I've heard tales of it.
I don't know if it was much before your time.
Not much.
And Tommy, I don't know if you remember that. It was American Express. They're issuing some kind of an instrument on the basis of having salad oil in these
tanks
and these railroad tank cars, right? And lo and behold, they found it wasn't the salad oil.
Last guy who told me that story was Mark Kaplan, by the way.
And the point I'm trying to make here is we woke up one day and we found that those mortgages weren't what they're supposed to be. And while, salad oil mortgages aren't the same, but it really is very similar to that. Now, what I found out, and Kevin and I deal with these bank examiners. We train them for the last 17 years. A lot of them come from these small towns. And they told us that when they would go into their banks and look at the mortgages and whatnot, they were told by their bosses and the regulators are saying, don't worry about it because they're going to ship them out and there is no exposure. And so you start out right there and you have a breakdown of regulation.
Originate to distribute. Get it off your books. Just move it.
Move it out. And they say, why waste time? Somebody else is going to buy it. Okay. And then you have a failure all the way around. Where were the accountants in these things here? Were the accountants satisfied? I don't know the answers, but you guys do. Were the accountants satisfied to accept what a rating agency did? I don't know if the accountants examined any of these instruments when they would go in. And so, yeah, there's a second breakdown in the regulatory system. And the third is, if you're telling me that the SEC had a lot of these prospectuses with a shelf registry and did not look at them, that's a third breakdown on this thing.
Yeah, essentially, what we find is most RMBS prospectuses, there's a core prospectus, which, as you know, is a blank check. It doesn't really include any elements of the deal. And then, as opposed to maybe a corporate bond where you have a shelf offering, that's a different thing. You have all this disclosure about the company in the public domain. But in the case of a mortgage-backed security, you get the core prospectus, which has no information about the deal, and then the prospectus supplement, where all the information is included. And the prospectus supplements simply weren't. The SEC told us that's the elephant in the room. They were not reviewed.
Did someone tell them not to review them?
Well, they were entitled under 415 to be declared automatically effective, and I don't know if the SEC had the people that could review them, to tell you the truth.
Well, that's a problem. That's a problem, and somebody's got to deal with it. And it's not a people problem. There are ways of dealing with it that they can deal with, have outside certifiers, things of that kind.
I'll give you an example and see. I remember when I was doing registration statements as a young lawyer, and if for corporate deals, and I think if I had this disclosure or prospectus, I might have gotten a comment from the SEC before it got declared effective. But the prospectus generally said the mortgages were underwritten to four pages of guidelines that are here described. However, some of these mortgages don't meet the guidelines. They're exceptions, but they are included as an exception because they have compensating factors. No definition of what a compensating factor really is, or how. Then it'll say substantially all, or sometimes a significant portion of these loans are in the pool as a result of exceptions.
Gee, is this what the disclosure?
This is what says. That was the disclosure.
And she didn't say anything. Wow.
And to make matters worse, the bankers knew that a number of the loans didn't have compensating factors. They had information that should have led them to that conclusion.
Well, I'm going to tell you once again, it's our gatekeeper theory.
which judge, the SEC's Court Finn, said, particularly with respect to the issue of self-registrations and the inability to review the deal data, was what they were relying on. They were relying on the gatekeepers.
That's correct. Could you, for the record, just as a securities law expert, talk a little bit about the gatekeeper theory and how it applies and how the securities laws work?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, the gatekeeper theory.
As a matter of fact, didn't you invent that term?
I certainly did. Not gatekeeper. I invented the term called access theory, which is what we use. When I was the director of enforcement, and probably a little bit before that when I was a deputy director, we never had enough people to do the full enforcement job. And the Congress would never give us enough people. And so I concocted this theory that said, look, based upon this factor, these factors, one, for a crooked promotion to be able to get any traction required the involvement of professionals. You needed a broker, investment banker, you needed a lawyer, you needed an accountant. And when you looked at the system at the time, that you found that the brokers were, you know, I think we had nine, I forget how many brokers we had, but it wasn't a whole lot of brokers. The great lawyers, law firms of the world, maybe a top 100. But the accountants, you only had 8 at that time. Now it's the big 4, used to be the big 8. And the theory was that we would hold responsible the people that gave access to the marketplace, the lawyers, the accountants, and the brokers, rather than trying to deal with every little two-bit crooked promoter. Of course, it's like trying to stamp out a colony of ants by killing the ants rather than going to where they're bred. And so the concept was that we would start suing the lawyers that didn't do their job, the accountants that didn't do their job, and the brokers. And we put that in effect. And we would then bring cases against, which never had been done before, against Merrill Lynch, who was the top broker. We sued, was it Whiten case, or some of the big, Brownwood. We would go against the big law firms that didn't do their job. We sued the top 8 accounting firms 28 times during my stay there. All on the theory, guys, that you got to do your job. You were the first responders. You've got to do the job. And then that, in effect, would permit we at the SEC give us a lot more coverage than we would have by, in effect, using this that's now called the gatekeeper theory. And I must say it worked. It worked. How did we know it worked? Because arising out of that concept was the other side of it, which is the compliance. On the private end of it, each of these entities said, okay, we need compliance now. We have to have people in-house to make sure we're complying with the law. And that's the way the whole compliance, which now engulfs the entire business community, everybody now has compliance people. But that's how they got compliance. Started out with the brokerage industry. Defense contractors then came up. The accountants now have it. The lawyers now have it. And so that's how the whole, as you say, inventing the internet. That's how this whole thing spread. And it works. Does it work 100%? No. But if you don't enforce it, then it'll break down. And I think here, if they were depending upon these people to do it, where were they? And indeed, it caused me in my Keating opinion when I went to the bench, using that concept, saying, well, where were these lawyers? Where were the accountants that allowed all these transactions that were dishonest? They didn't do their job, simply put.
So if that system's in place, what you're saying is it doesn't necessarily work 100% of the time, but it prevents systemic failure.
It should.
Yeah. And if it isn't being enforced, then that leaves open the possibility.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It should. If if you look at Sarbanes-Oxley, that is really a gatekeeper statute. They then expanded it. They now require certification by the CFO and the CEO. They require the audit committees to have certain gatekeeper. So I mean that took the whole concept of gatekeeper and put it into law, and that came about in several ways. And part of it was because the fellow who had the largest role there, a fellow named Steve Harris, who was Sarbanes' top guy, and I are good friends, so. We worked. Well, I helped him, but he was the guy but it should work. But as you can see, it didn't work here. It didn't work because I would have to ask, where were the accountants? Where? What did they do? Did they look at these at all? Have you looked at that at all?
Well, I was going to ask you. One of the things that Sarbanes-Oxley does is in Section 404 requires companies to maintain a system of internal controls.
Right.
Do you find anything inconsistent with that when you have investment banks springing $9 and $10 billion losses every week on investors? Would have thought a system of internal control would have prohibited that sort of money being lost that fast.
Well, the problem is it's not only Sarbanes-Oxley, but you go back to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and that requires companies to keep internal controls. I think everybody forgot about that. That's still in the books. Even though Congress, as you know, just watered down the internal controls as to the small companies. And they determined they don't have to have good internal controls, only the big companies. So, but, no, that's, yeah, I think the good internal controls, good compliance. But the problem with what's happening now is compliance is getting compromised. And if we find out the secret as to how that's happening, then I think we can break it loose. And I think the way it's happening one of the laboratory cases that we need to deal with is Goldman Sachs. See, why did compliance break down in that case?
We have looked at it a little bit with respect to Bear Stearns.
Yeah.
And it's abundantly clear that the compliance personnel were shouted down by the people who were generating the big bucks.
Well, there's a, there it is.
That is
see,
abundantly clear.
I had recommended at one point that a compliance officer has the responsibility and the duty to report if you see something that's illegal. And that's not my genius that's doing this. That's if you treat a compliance officer like a private inspector general, if you know under the Inspector General Act and in government agencies that is an independent responsibility the inspector general has, and he doesn't go through his own agency, he has to go directly to the Department of Justice. And that's something that has not been accepted, and it should be, that the compliance officer should be required to bring evidence of illegality directly to the...
An affirmative duty on him, is that what
you're saying? Affirmative duty, absolutely.
Actually, what you just said sounds very much what happened with Arthur Anderson. If the reports are correctly, I believe the Chicago office for Arthur Anderson was infuriated with some things going on with Houston. Houston just kept on shutting them up, saying, anyone could bring us $50 million a year in revenue. So that sounds very similar.
Well, two was the fact that they weren't absolutely certain that it was wrong. They thought that it had significant risk, and there ought to be some abatement process for that risk. But the folks were saying, "Well, my God, look what we're making, and how much we're making doing this. These mortgages are just marvelous. Just ride them to the edge of the world."
Absolutely right. You know, the thing that also bothers me, and again, I don't have the ability to understand this, under the old net capital rule, it was dollar for dollar, you really couldn't get into a situation like this. There was Basel came in, that defeated that, and again, the unfortunate part is that we allow the times to dictate how we operate. As you just point out, Tom, things are going so good. Who wants to be a skunk at the garden party? You know what I mean? And that's where it was. I mean, whenever I would question friends of mine at the SEC, or they would laugh at me. You know, they would say, "Who the hell is this guy? He's from a different age. Yeah. I don't understand all these things that are happening. Don't understand credit default swaps. Don't understand synthetic securities." Oh man, we're way ahead of that, and that I attribute to what I call the smartest guys on the block, who you probably work with some of them. But those are the guys that are trying to defeat the system, or not defeat, to use the system,
evade the system.
Well, usually to use the system and rework it and rewrite it, and it's awful when you think of it, because you don't have the incentive. The incentive is to concoct something around the system. The incentive is not to do what's right. Mm. And I don't know how you're ever going to get that done unless you have the things that I'm talking about. You're going to hold yourself accountable if you don't do it. Because I think the legal profession would be very... if they thought that they're going to be sued in some of these cases, their attitudes would change real quick. Or directors or whatnot.
Yeah. Or the rating agencies.
Yeah. Or the rating
office. There's also, and I don't know if you're interested in my opinion or not, but the person who actually hired me into the U.S. government in 1984, he and I, a fellow unfortunately since passed away, but Leo Blaber, former Federal Home Loan Bank president of Chicago, he and I were talking during the Glass-Steagall debate. And his concern was, it's a different culture. The culture of really well-run banks, or really well-run savings and loans, when they underwrite a loan, they underwrite a loan on the basis, can it get repaid? That's the entire basis of it. Will this loan get repaid? His concern dealing with investment bankers, their only concern, can they sell it? Whether that made sense or not.
You better get him identified on the record.
Oh, sorry. Kevin O'Connell, former Deputy Director of Special Cases for OTF, Office of Third Division.
You don't mind them?
No, not at all.
Yeah, you don't mind us taking these.
No, not at all. but, yeah, it really... And also, Judge, you made the comment about, they succumbed to pressure from overseas. That was the same debate in the late 1990s. Well, we had to repeal Glass-Steagall because our financial institutions can't compete with these giants that don't have these obsolete Glass-Steagall things. Same type of pressure, the same type of arguments.
Yeah, it's coming back, by the way. You can see it right now in the political spectrum right now. The people are saying that the outs are saying you want to come in. They're saying it's too much. And you look at all the debates: too much regulation, too much government, mm-hmm. too much this. And you're seeing that debate right away. We're gonna. This is only a small window. We have all this view that we need more regulation. It's usually a very small window, very short memory span, and it'll change within a year, we'll see it changed.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about the Basel and net capital rules again, if I'm not mistaken. That was sold to the Commission as a mechanism to put us on a competitive footing with our competitors overseas. We have to be able to do this.
Well, this one world kind of thing, you're seeing that in accounting and all these other things. I cringe when I see it, because, you know, to say that we have to, that we're gonna abide by a international standard when it might be different than our own standard. So you're gonna run into that again.
it used to, when I started, and I did a lot of work overseas, the U.S. standard of securities regulation and disclosure was the gold standard.
Absolutely.
And by a wide margin. And it was no mistake that we also have the deepest and broadest markets in the world. And over time, I think we've come down, they've come up. And, I did want to talk one thing about broker-dealer regulation and net capital. I think the repeal of Glass-Steagall had some effect there. I don't know if you care to comment on that. But in the days when the broker stood on its own, net capital meant something. But when it became part of a financial conglomerate, net capital became a very easy thing for the conglomerate to always comply with. You know, they just moved the leverage or outside the regulated entity.
Right. I think you're right. I haven't kept up with it. But what annoyed me, what I didn't understand was on Bear Stearns that I was told day by day as that unfolded right before we got to the collapse that they were in compliance with that capital.
I think every broker was. And
I don't understand how that could be.
Well, they had switched to the Basel format, but the carrot for the SEC on CSE or Basel was that they get to regulate the entire holding company.
Right.
Now, the problem with that, they didn't have nearly the resources to do it.
Self-regulation. Yes. Individual, they're going to regulate themselves. There was something that I sent you, Tom, that link to that, you know what I'm talking about, the link to that session at the SEC? Where
you did. You sent me the basement meeting and the film of it.
Yeah. You have it?
I haven't seen it.
He doesn't share everything with me.
Well,
I can't throw that up on this, can I?
What?
That link, I guess you have to go look at a computer. That link, because I have the link.
Yeah, you could do it there, but I think I know what we're talking about. Basically, it is the argument before the commission whereby...
Oh, you got to see this.
They were told, I said, look, you're tying our hands. We need to be able to compete on an international basis. And if we don't have some relief here, we're going to lose market share to these...
Went from 10 to 1 to 30 to 1.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the next subject. When I started out as a young attorney, the securities laws were about protecting investors. How did it change that it became about protecting investors, yes, but also keeping Wall Street competitive internationally and not denying innovation?
Wow. The seeds of that were sown, I guess, at the end of my tenure there. We, in enforcement, and that my tenure as director was from 74 to 81, was that all these attempts to open things up, we in enforcement had a crew of people who would look at that and see if we were going to be a possible enforce. And we were able to plug it up a number of times. But it finally, after I got left, and I don't think I could have withstood the tsunami that was coming, but you're right, the pressure was there. The pressure was we weren't competitive. The pressure was that we had to... We couldn't be restricted to 1932 concepts. We had to get into the real world, and that's why you got all the shelf registrations and all these other kinds of things. It was like taking down the traffic lights and say, "Go out, everybody, go out in the street and run anywhere you want."
There was a time when Rule 144 was only there for the purpose of facilitating a private investor's private placement security so that he could turn around and sell them after some change in circumstances.
Right. Yeah.
Now, 144A is an issuing tool and a vehicle.
It's amazing what happened. What happened with 144 was one of the things I just told you about, but we would watch what they were doing in Court Bend. As Tommy's right, what happened was when people had restricted securities, they all had to come to the SEC and to get the restrictions lifted, and they would have to show that the stock was taken for investment purposes. They held it for a certain number of years, and there's been a change in circumstances why they have to sell. And that had to be done by a no action letter. It occurred to me that what we needed, we had to take that away because there was too much of it. And so I came up with the idea, which was 144, was that we'd have a mini registration statement so that a person who wanted to sell restricted stock had to hold it, it was 2 years at the time, okay, had to indicate, file something with the SEC saying it's going to register, you know, that this is the stock that's going to sell. And then we made him put in that he had no inside information about the company and was not a member of the management of the company. And then you could sell on it. So you're right, 144 was a mini registration, which took away the fact of having to come to the SEC all the time. But that's what it was, but now it's become more...
And then it came where you could rely on counsel's opinion, provided the company had a public file.
They reduced it to 2 years, I forget what it is now, a year, 6 months, or no time sometimes. And so, yeah, things got distorted. Well, what you had was... In the SEC, which is comprised of different divisions. One of them is the Enforcement Division. One is the Corporation Finance Division, which deals with the companies and issues of the companies. One is Investment Company Division. One is the Market Division. And what happened was that there became a trend where the people in the Corporation Finance Division were brought in from the outside, and who many of them had worked for big firms who were doing the green goods work, so, you know, and they would come for 2 years and leave and go back, and that's still the trend right now. And of course their concept was to come in and make it easy for this kind of transactions to take place with as much ease as possible. And so they were there, what I used to call opening that front door, whereas the Enforcement Division was trying to close the back door. and it became a hell of a battle. And that's what's happened, that it was a trend to open up, less regulation, less this and less, and therefore you have it. Otherwise, how do you explain how you allow something that's not a security to be sold as a security, the synthetic security? How do you allow what you were saying about the mortgages? Mm. So yeah, I really think that there has to be an accommodation. You still have to have the regulation in some form that can prevent this massive kind of thing occurring again. I don't know if it's in there now, right now.
Mm-hmm. That brings me another topic, and that is financial innovation. Back in 1990, when Reg S and Rule 144A were adopted, they were basically adopted for the investment-grade debt market to make it more competitive in Europe, make the U.S. markets competitive with the Eurobond market.
Right.
That was a long time before some of the products being developed that we've seen since 2000. How does the SEC keep up? How does the regulatory system keep up with all this innovation?
Well,
got any ideas on that?
No, other than the fact that the mindset was to allow as much as you can. What we've taken down are the basic restraints and concepts that underwrite the securities laws. Maybe we need a little more originalization. We need some Scalia concept to come in there and find out what the original intent was.
First principles. Back to first principles.
Yeah, because it's not there anymore. It really isn't. I mean, for somebody, they sometimes still charge Section 5, but they got to be the dumbest people in the world who get caught with a Section 5 violation, which is an unregistered right. security, because it's not there. It's a difficult kind of thing, and if you look at the enforcement areas, that you're going to find that a lot of it was not it could not be dealt with. What you had in enforcement area, you would find trends that they then would have to deal with, the backdating of options and things of that kind, the financial frauds. But you don't find them dealing with the product area other than the two-bit crooks that were out there, inundated the market with some of the stuff. And I think you'll find that. And I think that a lot of that was left to self-regulation. And I don't think that area was effectively policed. My recollection is the SEC was bringing very few broker-dealer cases and investment bank cases up until this thing where they, where they could ignore it anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, how could you ignore Bear Stearns? How do you ignore Lehman? But I don't think those cases were being brought. Am I right, Tommy? Is that your recollection?
That's correct, Judge. They weren't bringing them.
They weren't bringing them. And I don't think Fenwick was bringing them. NESD or the New York Stock Exchange.
Nope.
So that's one of the problems that they had. They had free reign. I don't even remember, how did the Goldman case get brought? Was that?
That was SEC enforced. Are you talking about the case with the
Abacus?
Yeah,
Abacus case. Yeah, that was SEC. That was SEC enforcement. It was.
I know, but something
triggered it.
Yeah.
Well, I know this. It was not a secret. The fella Paulson who did the
right. The
sell job
right.
first took it to Bear, and the Bear folks says no. Mm-hmm. I mean, if one, I'd have to disclose it, and if I do disclose what's going on here, I won't get anybody to buy it, to take the long position.
Yeah, there's something that caused it, because you don't find that many major broker dealer cases. You found them on the breakdown of the wall some years back.
Yeah, research.
But that was a different kind of thing. I mean, it was systemic that they had to deal with it. But other than that, you don't find that they're getting too involved with the broker dealer.
Stanley, what's happened to the SEC in the States?
Well, I don't know, other than the fact that obviously you go back to our times, Tommy, and you see, my philosophy was very simple. I never had enough resources, and therefore we needed all the help we could get. And it meant working with the states. It meant working with NASD. And that's what we did. And these became, when I looked out there, we had all these states. They were just waiting to help us. And as Tom knows, that's how we met. But I would attend every one of their meetings. I would, when we had a guy like Tom, who was the administrator in Alabama, and he wanted to be part of the team, we work together very, very closely. So, I mean, it's I think there became a sort of little bit of an arrogant kind of view of the SEC that they didn't want to be bothered with the states, which was a, which is a terrible mistake. But I think that's changed, has it not?
I see shifts or trends that Joe Horn has been doing a really fine job.
I think that's changed. I think the SEC understands. I mean, look, we've had years where the SEC was trying to work with industry to get preemption, weren't they?
Yes.
I mean, that would
trying to preempt us.
I mean, that would have been so far from my standpoint, you would not believe it.
Well, they've largely been successful. They've largely been successful on preemption.
Well, in some areas, I think, just like, I mean, you take the whole bar association. Are we now ready for a nationwide bar? I mean, this is ridiculous to have every little state have their own little bar. And so, yeah, I think everybody should realize that certain areas you should, but not in the enforcement area. I mean, you need a cop on the beat. You're not going to do away with all the local cops. And you know, when what used to bother me was when some chairman of the commission would tell me, Stan, don't bring me these little cases. They're too little. Well, I would say to him, you never know when a little case is going to become a big case, number one.
You'll win snakes before they get big.
And beyond that, everybody's entitled to protection. Can you imagine a police officer, someone said someone stole my bank, and the police officer, that's too small for us to look at. No, you can't. You can't. An enforcement official can't turn their heads. They can find alternative ways of doing it. And I think that's a mistake when they say we're only going to look at this or only going to look at that.
De minimis standards for enforcement.
Well, it's a roadmap around. It gives the people that are trying to defeat the system the ability to defeat. Look at the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. How that gets gone. One of the major things in which they're using on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is petty cash. Because why? Because the auditors don't look at petty cash. It's too petty. So if you're going to make payments, you make it out of petty cash. I mean, it's the radar screen. Everybody tries to get under the radar screen.
Yeah.
So
you you have an outline here that in section C, talking about carelessness and recklessness of players in creating instruments that brought about the crisis, obviously in reference to the mortgage securitizations, the lawyers who created them, the credit agencies and the role they play. You hadn't talked too much about the credit rating agencies, particularly in connection with the ratings of the RMBS and these structured investments. What are your views there?
The views there are obvious, and I don't know a whole lot about it, but what I do know is that was an unregulated area. And yet we ordained them with tremendous powers. They could make or break something, and they had no standards, and nobody was looking at them. I mean, it's just obvious that there was an area that was just waiting to be mined by the unscrupulous people.
What would you do to correct it?
Well, I think the law involving credit agencies now gives the commission tremendous power, and I do think I think they might have enough power. I haven't looked into this, but I do think they have enough authority now to require registration and to examine them.
How is it that we should have done something differently about the origination of mortgages and the securitization of mortgages? Bob, you might show him your reverse pyramidal arrangement. We believe, or we have a thought about it, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Look at this. Yeah, go ahead.
The thought is that In the old days,
yeah,
mortgages stayed down here in the regulated banking sector.
That's exactly right.
And guys like Kevin came in,
yeah,
and if they were writing bad mortgages,
yeah,
pretty soon they were told to stop, and that put a hold on the problem.
Right.
However, when securitization came along,
right,
mortgages started flowing into unregulated securities market, largely unregulated.
You're absolutely right.
Once it goes through the gate, it's unregulated.
You're right.
And there's a lot of...
And this became unregulated because they knew that it was going to go through the gate. There was no need.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just what you said, that hey, they're going to be off the books. Don't worry about looking at them.
Right.
Yeah. And right at this juncture, you get the underwriters, lawyers, or the gatekeepers.
Right.
Now, John Coffey, I don't know if you've seen his article or not, but he also puts the rating agencies here and calls them gatekeepers, but I'm not sure that's...
I think they're part of it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And then the SEC. But the SEC is mostly sidelined because as long as these things are highly investment-grade rated, they go right through without looking.
Absolutely. But the one area there that I'm not convinced... is getting a pass as the accountants.
Well, what is the role of an accountant in an RMBS?
Well, I think, and overall, my view as an accountant, if he's going to allow something to be on somebody's balance sheet, has got to assure himself the value of that asset.
In this instance, is not that role played by the trustee, who is of the trust, who is responsible for marshaling those assets, bringing them into the trust, and making sure all the paperwork is done so that it's that on day one when we launch, we have all the mortgages, all the notes, and we have figured out how to distribute the cash flow from those anticipated revenues.
Well, I'm not as clear, obviously, as you are as to the methodology here, but I would assume that some of the financial institution was carrying these instruments on their books as an asset.
At least in the pipeline. When they're in the pipeline, they're in inventory.
Yes, okay, and so they're inventory. And at some point, somebody has got... remember, a balance sheet is a picture of a status of a company's assets and liabilities as of a certain date. So when the account goes in as of that date, he has to take inventory of what they have. And on that book is the asset, am I right? The mortgage. And or the group of mortgages. And it seems to me that the accountant's got, just as in the salad oil case, has got to make sure that value is there.
You have to go out and check the tank card.
I think where that system falls down is that the mortgages are moving through the system very quickly, and as long as they don't go delinquent while they're in the hands of the bank, I don't think the accountants looked at them too closely.
Well, they still got to satisfy themselves of that asset. Now, you're saying, Tommy, that because it's packaged as a trust, the concept would be, why is that different than if they own General Motors, right?
Yeah,
in other words, you don't ask the accountant, if I own General Motors stock, you don't ask the accountant to go back and determine whether the price of the General Motors stock is correct, right? But the difference here is a difference here. I mean, that's the argument they're going to give you. But the difference here is there's no value on these things. And that's why, in other words, if you had on a investment company or whatnot, investments in companies where there was no stock market value on it, the accountant has to certify that that's the correct value that's being placed on that. And then I think they have to do it with the
account.
Well, the question is, you got to ask that question. How do they get a pass? And is there a flaw in the accounting concept to give them that pass?
That's a good question. Maybe Kevin can help us on that. It's my understanding is that they're always on the lookout for delinquencies. And as long as it's current it doesn't raise the red flag for the accountants that maybe it's overvalued.
That's generally the case, although you also have to look at the structure of the loan, and that's where you get into examination and examination disputes with accountants and the like. For instance, on construction loans, it's almost impossible for the loans to go delinquent because part of the interest payment is actually within the loan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be the trustee, because I think all the trustee is supposed to do is to make sure the documents are there. For instance, let's say I securitize these two bonds.
Right.
They're both in default. I think all the trustee's job is to make sure is that I've turned over these bonds to him. Whether or not they have value
Correct.
Or not is probably not his call.
Correct. I
yeah,
agree.
But what we're seeing today
right.
with respect to the RMBS is that the trust do not own the mortgages.
That's another issue, though.
Oh, okay.
You see this on the front page of the Post today. This is an amazing.
The trust.
Oh, yeah. You really came at the right time, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's like sticky paper here.
So what are they being paid to do?
You got to really look into that.
Well, no, that's a good question.
It's pretty much open and shut. I mean, they didn't own the mortgage.
Yeah. This is the biggest fraud since I don't know how you would even describe what was anything like it. I mean, it's bigger than Tommy, even what you told me yesterday. I think it's bigger than the biggest thing I've ever seen.
It is.
It's mind-boggling.
I mean, billions and billions of dollars.
And we don't know
Hundreds
how to sort it all out.
Yeah.
How do you sort out a home and a homeowner who is being foreclosed upon by a trust that doesn't have title to the property?
Right.
How far do you go back? Do you go back to the originator? Suppose you go back to Long Beach, or suppose you go back to New Century. They're bankrupt. They're out of business. They're gone.
It's a mess.
They've got their feet in the air. They're dead.
There were mortgage-backed securities that weren't backed by mortgages.
Problem right now. Right, this is...
Oh, okay.
Can you imagine this is made off in steroids or in steroids? This is made off.
Good example.
This is a big...
Good analysis.
There's nothing there.
It's more like the back office problem we had before we got to the security.
You're right.
Doing it all by
hand.
They
right.
could not keep up with it.
Right. Well, but...
They couldn't keep
but,
up.
But this puts a different light on things that shows you how bad the system was and regulation failed. Regulation had to fail to permit this to happen. And I mean, this one I've got to put on the right on the regulators. There's no other way. I mean, one or two of these things is fine, but you can't have this massive kind of thing with the bank regulators going in, with the accountants. And that's why this accounting end of it, I am not convinced that they're absolved. I am not convinced that the profession's absolved. And even if it is, that there certainly have got to be strictures now put in that says, look, you got a role to play here. What is an accounting statement if it's going to take away a certain part of the balance sheet and say, we don't look at it? And so you really got to look at all the gatekeepers here, all of it.
I think today the accounting firms would probably look at it a little bit differently, because they now know what happens if the pipeline stops. And that's a risk that maybe they hadn't really fully appreciated before. They should have. But.
And their compliance officers that raised the issue with respect to the amount of the mortgages in the pipeline at a given time, when they were shouted down, the people who were shouting them down now appreciate the risk.
But you know what amazes me, Tommy, is the lack of, when BP had that big spill, it was the tsunami. It was, but this has not yet sunk in.
No, it hasn't.
This has not yet sunk in. How bad is this? I mean, where is it? I mean, I haven't seen the media looking
Stanley,
at this.
I want you to think about this. Could be the second financial crisis.
Well, it could be.
It could trigger that.
It could be. Well.
I have to admit, you just shocked me, because that kind of destroys some of my safety and soundness restrictions I used to put on some small institutions. But one of the things that got the attention of Washington, I was hired back in Chicago, is I was able to pick up a couple of scams on small mortgage brokers. They were selling small fifths. They actually ruined one small fifth in Freeport. And we saw that they were both selling and servicing and issuing all these statements, and they're telling the first, well, look, saving you all this money, not only are you getting a good yield, but you don't have to service it, you don't have to... And our examiner first pointed out, wait a minute, they're doing all this themselves. There's no trustee anywhere. How do you know they're telling you the truth? And one young chief financial officer of a small institution came in and said, look at this. It's perfect. They bought 140 loans, and he showed me the amortization schedules. And I remember my boss and I, he's older than I am, but both of us, we had more real-world experience. The payment structures were perfect.
Nothing's that perfect.
Nothing. No prepayments. Nobody apparently got sick during this period of time. Nobody lost their payment in the world. And we looked at it and said, this ain't right. There's no way this can be true. You've got to go in and go into that mortgage broker and look at the individual files, the individual payments. What the hell's going on here? Well, they fought us for a while. Said, you know how much it's going to cost to do this? Finally, we got them to get an attorney in there. 35% of the mortgage was delinquent. It was a Ponzi scheme. They were just selling the mortgages, the payments of the mortgages that were then using to make the principal and interest payments. So I said, look, and basically we said to all these small thrifts, we realize it's a cost, but you buy and sell mortgages with somebody else. It's got to be an independent trustee verifying the payments are coming in, the payments are going out. And what you just said kind of shocks me. What the hell are they being paid for then?
Well, they had the notes. They just didn't have the mortgages.
Okay.
So they're unsecured creditors.
Yeah. But Tommy, I don't know. Well, they're going to have to fix the blame for this last thing on somebody. I think Angel Ease, if he's smart, would take this right on and get it, because he's at the closest ability to do it, having done the work that you guys have done. he should reroute anything he got on this one and get into it, because it
we'll
is
have
a big
discussion
one.
After this is over.
Exactly.
We don't want to get on the record.
Yeah, that's
right. On that, but it's frightening.
It is. It's very frightening, and it's very, very unbelievable that this could happen in this day and age. And again, if you go back to my gatekeeper theory, there's a lot of hell to pay here.
Anything else, Judge, that you think that we might have omitted in connection with this review of the current financial crisis and what generated it?
Well, we do know about Brooks Lee Born being shouted down. We do know about people saying regulation is no good, that the markets regulate themselves. We've got to knock that one right out of the box. The one thing that does bother me, and I know you guys are not to come up with any kind of cures, but what always bothered me is the concept that we have in this country about insuring deposits of only, it used to be 100,000, now it's 250. And what people don't understand is the banking industry, that they perform several different functions. One of the functions that they perform is the payments function. That is a quasi-governmental function, because this whole country would come to a standstill if we couldn't, if people couldn't have the banks to route the checks and whatnot. Now, with respect to that function, it should be 100%. As I understand, there is some rule that says a bank can get up to 100% if it does certain things on its deposits. That's a relatively new rule, but I do think that a commercial bank, with respect to that aspect, it should be 100%. I think there's a terrible...
And the thing that should be 100% is the function that relates to the payment of...
The payments function, as opposed to the investment function. Now, an investment function, that should be the same as any other, but But think of this. I use General Motors, but General Electric, anybody. I mean, they can't worry about having 100,000 or 250 insured when they have a bank that's making payroll. How can that be? The German system has it 100%.
Well, they do.
They insure the banks 100%. And I think that we really got to think about that, because if there's anything that would have brought our country down, was the concept that people would have lost all their money, big corporations, everybody would have lost their money if the bank went under and it wasn't taken
well,
over.
We came very close. Yeah. Recall, if you will, the crisis we ran into right after Lehman Brothers failed, when the commercial paper market went to hell in a handbasket.
Right.
All these tier two issuers couldn't go to the market. They didn't have money. CVS couldn't restock insulin. Other entities couldn't. You couldn't buy weapons. Couldn't do the vests that they use for the troops in Iraq.
You can't ask people to take their money and put it in 1,000 different banks.
Right.
You can't do it. And that's such a simple fix. And is one that I think this thing showed the need to do that, because people were doing crazy things. Money was going into federal debt, governmental debt that was paying no interest. That's fine. I don't. But just for the safety, and then you don't want to drive all that into the government. The private sector needs it. So I think that something's got to be done there. And I think this crisis showed that people should have the right to feel safe if they have their checking money, the money in their checking account in a bank. And I think that's a very important thing. What do you think, Kim?
I think that's true. It would certainly make it much simpler. Of course, I could also understand the populist complaint about that. Basically, it's a way to protect the major banks again, but because most of the payments go through the big banks.
They're running
a... For all intents and purposes, we do that anyway.
It's a governmental function they're performing. If you didn't have them, you'd have to have a national federal bank that would do it all. So they are performing a governmental function when they make payments to make them. I don't know of anything. The other thing that came to my mind was the concept of FEMA kind of an organization. I think they're trying to do that by this Council of Cardinals that they have. But the organization where there is this catastrophe can go in there and deal with it. For natural disasters, you have one. I think you might need one for these financial disasters. Have a FEMA type organization. Well, we all finished?
Off the record?
Yeah, we are off the record. And thank you so much, Judge Borkin. We're off the record at 12:36.
Well, thank you.